Chapter 1. The Local Boys. The local boys called it Little Africa. What troubled Christopher Bennett was the erroneous perception of some who referred to an unremarkable field at Webster and Garfield as Little Africa, having no concern for the importance of the real Little Africa. The confusion arose when Sterling Hunt made an offhand comment one day at recess about meeting up at Little Africa next to G&N. Somehow, for some reason that made no sense whatsoever to Christopher Bennett, the name stuck with a group of obviously unsophisticated and less cultured boys, primarily those who lived west of Howard Street. The insidious nature of the deception surrounding the imposter Little Africa was magnified by the nearby G&N convenience store that attracted children from as far away as Santa Rita. From the moment one opened the unassuming, pewter-colored handle, dusty glass door, surrounded by sun-faded cardboard signs that screamed promotions like Farm Fresh Eggs, 78 cents a dozen, and Whole Milk, $2.24 a gallon, the overwhelming sense of gratification was palpable. The aroma of smoked sausage was met with the sight of a gleaming candy aisle that rivaled any store in West Texas, the clap of flip-flops on the linoleum floor with a corner missing here and there, the almost startling cold of the air conditioner that seemed like overkill for such a small store, the sound of KGKL tunes wafting through the air. It was all too much. The desire always outweighed the budget of any kid north of Sherwood Way. Eyes would drift from Jordan almonds to candy cigarettes to Astro Pops to peanut patties and on and on. They would wander around listlessly, sometimes for half an hour or more, picking up one thing, returning it to get another, rarely put back where it belonged, counting change, grabbing one of those strange compressed powder lollipops, and finally negotiating with themselves about which item was more desirable. Those who were really down on their luck had options, too, as they could browse the bottom shelf where individually wrapped candies were available for only a nickel. Meanwhile, Mr. Ben would sit on a bar stool behind the counter, sometimes reading the paper and sometimes staring at a black-and-white TV with rabbit ears, showing more static than content. And he would always ask the same question when they checked out. "You boys got everything you want?" It was a rhetorical question, of course, because the answer was always a resounding no in their minds. Yet the word that left their lips was always yes. They would check out and leave, oftentimes not realizing that they were more than a few cents short. But Mr. Ben didn't say anything. The treasures left behind would wait for another day. Even Christopher Bennett loved to run to G&N. That was part of the frustration of it all, because G&N sat right next to the fake Little Africa, seeming to lend credibility to the name that it didn't own. The name that Sterling so casually attributed to it one day at recess, having no concern for the travesty of what he had done. It was the ultimate disrespect to what was in Christopher's mind hallowed ground. Did he not know that the real Little Africa was a magical place that stretched from the underbelly of the Junius Street Bridge almost to Edmund Boulevard? Was he unaware or just ignoring that the enormous pit surrounded by terrifying, almost vertical dirt trails was the entrance to a whole network of underground tunnels built by a lost civilization? That was the word on the street anyway, and Chris believed it. A less-in-the-know kid from Alta Loma Elementary once postulated that it was just a big hole that had been dug for the dirt and caliche for sake of Houston-Hart Freeway that was slated for construction in the coming years. Christopher Bennett knew this couldn't be the case because he'd heard the stories, and he just had a sense that something fantastical was surrounding Little Africa. In his mind, it had to be a portal to some other place, some other dimension, some other something that would be a complete departure from the unremarkable nature of day-to-day life in San Angelo, Texas. Even if the more unbelievable stories surrounding Little Africa were false, there was simply no comparison to the field at Webster and Garfield. Sure, that one had riding trails with some awesome moguls that could send an unprepared idiot flying into cactus if encountered unaware. But there was no enormous pit larger than a city block, and at least 40 feet deep with steep trails winding down the sides. There was no overpass as the gateway to the enchanted land beneath the city streets, and no nearby capillary of the Concho River. There was no darkness like the shadow that was cast over Little Africa by the overgrown mesquite trees that surrounded it, not to mention the bridge that loomed overhead with a strange, echoing kablop-kablop of cars going from nowhere to nowhere all day. The surface-level field just didn't have near the mystical energy that Chris sensed at the real Little Africa. Of course, it didn't have G&N either, but that only added to the sense of mystery and uneasiness that one experienced after descending down the supporting slope of the Junius Street overpass. G&N felt safe and familiar. On the front door, in the lower left-hand corner, there was a fluorescent orange poster with a jet-black hand. All San Angelo children understood that hand to mean safe place. At Little Africa, there was no benevolent Mr. Ben, no comfort in the blend of smells, feelings, sights, and sounds. Rather, this place seemed completely foreign to San Angelo, as if it didn't belong. The authentic Little Africa was a strange, dangerous place that only the kids knew about, or so they thought. It was the location where Christopher Bennett first faced his fear and rode his banana seat bicycle down the washed-out slope that was once some sort of vehicle ramp. It was dark and smelled like damp soil and mildew. It mattered, probably more to Chris than anybody else in all of San Angelo, or the whole world for that matter. It held weight in his mind to the point that the local boys referring to another location as Little Africa frustrated and enraged him. It drove him to preach with great fervency to every soul he encountered about the location of the real Little Africa, if the topic came up, and sometimes when it didn't. He was passionate about it, but couldn't articulate all of the reasons. The group of 10 to 12-year-old boys that Chris ran with mostly attended Austin Elementary School. Justin Cade was the only regular who was enrolled in the Catholic school downtown. His grandmother, whom he lived with, was the impetus behind that arrangement. He was in the 5th grade, as was Chris. Two of the boys were in the 4th grade, Emmett Jackson and Trent Brennan. Kyle Markham was in the 6th grade. The gulf between the 6th grade and the lower one seemed like a vast expanse, and Kyle stood out as the go-to leader when stacked against the others. He was held in high regard by the neighborhood boys. Kyle was almost a foot taller than Justin, and Justin was taller than the others. But it wasn't about his physical appearance. It was more about his general demeanor. From their perspective, he seemed to have the wisdom of a sage due to an intrinsic leadership quality that carried weight with just about every other kid in his circle, and even some who attended Lee Junior High. Kyle lived on North Street, two doors down and across the street from Chris. The two had become friends, due more to proximity than common interests, and so Kyle became part of the group over the course of years. If not for that, he would have kept his distance. Kyle understood his place in the world, and he knew that just about everybody in all three sixth-grade classes looked to him as the essence of cool. That was a status that he would not have risked by interacting with lower-grade schoolboys out in the open, if not for knowing Chris as his neighbor. Despite his reservations and all of the risks where his reputation and street cred were concerned, his outside relationship with Chris and the others eventually outweighed his pride to the point that everybody at Austin Elementary knew that they were a pack. Kyle had made the rounds with just about every girl in the sixth grade that fit a certain criteria. He easily won the hearts and minds of those girls who were classified as out of my league by most boys. In private, when Kyle was away from the campus and chatting with the group, he explained that he'd only hook up with girls that have curves. In short, Kyle had all the right stuff, or at least that perception in his own eyes and those who knew him. He also had a younger brother, an even younger sister, and most importantly, a father and a mother who both lived at home. His family life was stable, and that was more than any of the other boys in the group would ever know. Kyle was in his usual place at the head of the group as they rode along North Van Buren on a sunny, perfect September Saturday. None of the crew gave a second thought to the importance and value of the time that they were living in. Even Emmett, with all of his wisdom and foresight, never considered that 1979 would soon give way to 1980, and the world would start changing at such an exponential rate that they would all look back after what seemed like only minutes to wonder what had happened to their lives. No, they weren't contemplating anything so philosophical or forward-thinking on this day. Kyle was just determined to stay in front of the pack, knowing that Justin had a tendency to occasionally challenge his position. The others were following along, oblivious to the significance of this point in time or their place in the world. None of the boys realized that they'd never be as content and conflicted as they were in the fleeting span of time from late 1979 until the end of summer 1980. Justin often made moves to improve his social standing with passive-aggressive tactics that he didn't mastermind because he didn't even realize that he was doing it. This behavior likely arose from his earlier childhood with a drug-addicted mother, who never knew which one-night stand was Justin's father. Her unceremonious departure further contributed to Justin's independence and simmering rage. There was no legal transfer of custody when his grandmother, Edna Murdoch, assumed the role of caretaker to Justin. All he could remember was being dropped off to stay with Edna for one night, or so he was told. He had questions when Claire failed to return the following day and yet wasn't terribly emotional about it because there was no closeness between Justin and his mother. He was more of a burden than anything, sleeping on the couch or on the floor as Claire hopped from man to man. Sometimes it was a manufactured home at the Twin Buttes RV park, and sometimes it was a chaotic house or apartment, almost always with little to no furniture. Once he lived for almost 3 weeks at the Roosevelt Motel, where he slept on a pallet in the bathroom with his head beneath a filthy toilet. That was 4 random men ago. Then Claire dropped him for a visit at Edna's house, and that was the last he ever saw or heard from her alive. After 3 days, he overheard Edna arguing on the phone, which he knew to regard his apparently new normal. The memory of Edna holding the yellow-gold handset that was attached to an avocado-green wall-mount rotary phone never left Justin. She was in the kitchen working on dinner, nearly overcome by heat for which the dining room window unit could not compensate. The extra-long rubbery wound cord that connected the handset to the base unit was stretched almost to capacity as she aggressively darted around the kitchen, all the while holding the phone to her ear by pressing it against her shoulder, keeping her hands free. Justin's eyes landed on the tangles that formed when the cord compressed, and he wondered why it never returned to a perfect state, like a narrow rubber slinky. The cord had become all knotted and twisted so that it could no longer assume the original shape, much like Justin's life. Edna kept moving the handset from one ear to the other, all the while rattling off enraged rants. He heard phrases like, "Your choices are your responsibility," and "I'm too damn old for this." In the end, she slammed the receiver onto the base unit and cried. 30 minutes later, they were having dinner, Justin mostly picking at the spaghetti while Edna just sat and stared at the window. Neither touched their sweet tea that was mostly watered down with partially melted ice cubes. The only comfort was the coolness and the sound of the window unit, whirring incessantly and only really keeping the dining room cool. Finally, after about 10 uncomfortable minutes, Justin looked at Edna and she looked at him. Then she exhaled and partially smiled. He belonged to her from that moment on. Whether it was Claire's abandonment or her utter lack of love and affection for the 6 years that he did know her, it was obvious that Justin had become very independent and always wanted the world to know that he didn't really need anybody. He wasn't looking to Kyle for leadership, and he was just as content alone as with the group. At least that was the impression that everybody had of him. From time to time, he would get competitive and challenge the pecking order, causing Kyle to stand up and pedal harder to stay in the lead. Justin approached life this way, almost never obeying Sister Martinez the first time when she barked orders at him. The irony that Edna enrolled Justin at the Catholic school was not lost on the others. The discipline and regimen of that place was in stark opposition to Justin's nature. There was a quiet obstinance brooding in Justin's heart. It was under the surface, not quite rebellion, but not far from it. That side of him was visible as the boys rode against the curb on North Van Buren on that gorgeous September day in 1979. Soon the boys arrived at the strange intersection of Forest Park and North Van Buren, which was an unusual crossroads for several reasons. It was there that Forest Park became Wilshire to the east, although there was another section of Forest Park just about 30 feet ahead that meandered on to Jefferson, like a lost orphan. So two roads intersected, but it was technically three, for no discernible reason. Also, the rhythm of the neighborhood was broken at this intersection. Whereas everything to the south was cleanly organized as tract homes on a consistent grid, Forest Park wound along the contour of Brentwood Park, and Brentwood Park was built around the windy Brentwood Creek. The consistent order of what lay behind was lost as the boys emerged into the park area. This was the place where 4 of the 5 boys would almost always cringe because Trent usually wanted to ride through the creek if the water was low, a prospect that always led to muddy bikes and bodies if the group capitulated. It was fun the first few times, but the group had grown weary of that adventure, except for Trent. He loved the challenge and the filth of what was, in his mind, a trek down the Amazon, dodging alligators and venomous water moccasins. The creek that ran through Brentwood Park had once been a tributary of the Concho River. It was usually just a dry ravine, except when the rains came. The meager indentation existed with little change until the late 1800s, when San Angelo started to grow from a nascent frontier town to a well-known West Texas trading post called St. Angela, also known for the nightlife. Eventually, the park area was allocated by the city, and the east-west boundaries were defined from Howard to Jefferson. Initially, there were wooden bridges that spanned the ravine on either end, but finally, the land was shored up and the creek was hemmed in and cut off, both from the source and from the destination. The terrain to the west had served as the source until then, breathing life into Brentwood Creek whenever it rained, which was seldom, but heavy on occasion. There was also an underground spring that fed the western end of the creek. but it stopped flowing when the land was leveled with caliche and wagon loads of topsoil that were shipped in from nearby Ben Ficklin and Christoval, and some from as far away as Robert Lee. A natural pond formed on the eastern area of the park as the meager flow pooled, some filtering down through the rocky earth and red clay, eventually finding its way to the underground feeders of the Concho River. The problem with Brentwood Creek was that it had a tendency to throw destructive tantrums when heavy rains came. Violent West Texas thunderstorms caused the stagnant creek to transform into a raging torrent from time to time, washing out the roadways and leaving behind a muddy swamp that swallowed wagon wheels to the axle and stayed wet for months at a time. This continued well after the advent of automobiles until finally the city of San Angelo launched a public works project in 1946 to clean up Brentwood Park for good. It was then that they excavated and widened the ravine to about 25 feet across and 4 feet down, shoring up the sides with mortared stone and the base with concrete. One socialite who was well connected to M.L. Leddy's and also had a husband on the city council had the idea that they should add boat ramps in hopes that locals might float along in canoes, twirling parasols like a George Surratt painting. The idea had legs, but ultimately failed because the almost stagnant water bred hordes of mosquitoes, or was useless as a recreation outlet when empty or almost empty, as it usually was. Nevertheless, the three boat ramps remained. What nobody considered was that Trent Brennan would grace planet Earth in the year 1969. And he would see adventure and thrills in a man-made creek having a layer of moss and mud atop a concrete floor, sometimes holding some residual water and sometimes just viscous mud. To Trent, trudging through Brentwood Creek on a bicycle, fighting to spin the crank once more, or risk falling over in the sludge or against the jagged stone wall, that was the ultimate thrill. The boat ramps made for excellent entry points. One could ride west all the way to Howard, where the creek floor elevated and emptied out right onto the street. But unfortunately for Trent, the other boys weren't nearly as enthusiastic about running the creek, as he called it. Brentwood Park interested Trent not just for the excitement of the ride, but also because of rumors of what lied beneath. Stories had circulated for decades of how the creek excavation had unearthed human remains when the park was formalized in 1946. The estimate ranged between 30 to 50 partial skeletons that were uncovered while digging out the creek. Supposedly, this discovery was kept on the down low by Concho Valley Excavation Corporation, which was the company that was hired to engineer the new and improved Brentwood Creek. The project was their first of any consequence, and uncovering an ancient graveyard of unknown origin would have derailed the whole effort. So, as the story went, it was quietly agreed by all involved, including some who were stalwarts of the upper stratification in San Angelo, that they would discreetly relocate the bones in the truckloads of dirt that were hauled off. They were supposed to repurpose the soil to an arboretum along the river, but the risk of exposure was too great. If any bones were overlooked and discovered at the new location, then the whole plan would unravel. The cover story was that the soil exhumed from Brentwood Creek was more stone than usable topsoil. In an effort to stave off any questions, topsoil was brought in from elsewhere and relocated to the arboretum at no additional charge. The dig sites were roped off, and curious onlookers were redirected with warnings of voids that might cause the surrounding soil to collapse at any moment. Each day they made a careful sweep to ensure that no exposed remains were visible, just in case a local looky-loo crept in during the night. Eventually, the two city blocks of creek were dug out, the walls of stone were built, and the concrete was laid. All workers were compensated, along with a kickback for their silence, and the story was buried. But word gets around in San Angelo, Texas, and it didn't stay a secret forever. This led to all sorts of speculation that there must be bodies buried all throughout Brentwood Park, most likely of Indian origin, although there was no documented evidence that any clothing or artifacts were discovered to warrant the assumption. Questions swirled about the supposed destination for the relocated human remains. The general consensus was that they had been driven somewhere far away from San Angelo and dumped, but it was all just rumor. The final interesting tidbit regarding this local lore was that the alternate site where the replacement topsoil was obtained, leaving an enormous hole in the ground, had later become known by the local boys as Little Africa. This rumor was contradicted by the state of Little Africa in 1979, because there had obviously been recent activity at the site. But it remained the scuttlebutt with the local boys nonetheless. The boys descended down a small hill and passed through the North Van Buren Forest Lane-Wilshire intersection, scantly checking for cross traffic with no real ability to stop in time had they encountered a vehicle. None were present, and so they sailed on through the section of North Van Buren that bisected Brentwood Park. The creek crossed beneath them, emptying out to the pond on their right. Trent started to yell out, "Let's run the creek," only to be immediately interrupted by a resounding and collective "No." Trent stopped mid-sentence and gazed longingly at the creek to his left as they all passed by, standing on their pedals and enjoying the turbo boost that the hill and gravity had lent them. Then he started singing American Pie. Actually, it was more like melodic yelling. Trent had a habit of responding to events with song if he could conjure up any tune even remotely applicable. American Pie was a go-to for all things that entailed a goodbye. There was a whole litany of other songs that Trent could belt out with a nanosecond to assess and attach the song to the event. This idiosyncrasy was only one part of an intrinsic wit that emerged in Trent even as a toddler. His sudden and unexpected humor was firmly entrenched by the time he fell in with the group. Even as a fourth grader, Trent could counter any moment with comedy, sarcasm, or a song. His title of class clown was well earned. Nobody could pin down the origin of Trent's offbeat humor. He had lived an unremarkable life, moving to San Angelo from McKamey in 1974. He was too young to remember the volatile and abusive relationship that his mother endured before she fled to San Angelo and eventually took a job at the Ethicon plant. Recovery was a process, but the two of them were well established with a small two-bedroom house on Coleman Street within a few short years. Trent's life had settled into a fairly consistent rhythm by 1979, except for one little hiccup that was growing in Mom's belly. Neighbors didn't really speak of it because the single mom with the loudmouth kid in the brown house didn't move the needle of interest to the point that her pregnancy caused much gossip. She didn't speak of it either, not even to Trent, except to warn him that a sibling was forthcoming by January and to expect some changes. Trent took this in stride, but there was concern that their limited resources would be spread thin, and he was especially bothered that he would likely have to share a room. The downside of a trek north through Brentwood Park was the upside of the opposing hill. The entire park was part of a larger depression in the natural terrain, like a small valley. This was particularly problematic for Emmett because he was the smallest, and also due to his asthma and overall sickly disposition. Much of his short 10 years had been an uphill battle for Emmett, having been born premature and not expected to live. However, much to the surprise of just about everybody who was following his progress, he pulled through. His father didn't let on about his disappointment when the doctors advised that he just might make it after all. It had seemed for a few days like their little problem was just going to go away. Nevertheless, Emmett held on, much to Dad's chagrin. Then there was the accident on Knickerbocker at Johnson when he was 7. His mother, Madeline Jackson, was driving home from a 12-hour shift at Angelo Community Hospital. She attempted to turn left, obstructing Frank Mendez, who was running late to his job at Furr's Grocery. Whether the sun was in her eyes or she wasn't paying attention was unclear. Frank hit her so hard that the car almost did a 360 back into the lane she was turning from. Then another truck hit her dead on, and that was the end of Madeline Jackson. The incident left Emmett alone with his father, Will. The loss was difficult, but it also solidified and strengthened his inherent tenacity. That tenacity had wrestled him from the grip of death as a newborn, and it kept pushing him on through all of the obstacles and setbacks, finding him at the back of the pack and pedaling with all his might on that sunny September day in 1979. All of Emmett's history had also caused him to be somewhat introverted and contemplative by nature. Oftentimes he was just there, riding, sitting, drawing, reading, or whatever. Then when he did speak, it usually seemed very profound, causing the whole group to stop and listen. It wasn't that every word uttered by Emmett was wise beyond his years, but his input was so sparse in comparison to the other boys that his words carried disproportionate weight. He was just as much a part of the group as were Kyle, Justin, Trent, and Chris, although his personality could not have been more different than all of them. But that was really true of the entire group. Each boy had his place, his quirks, strengths, and glaring weaknesses. Kyle's pride was matched by Justin's rage, while Trent's naivete was outdone only by Emmett's overall physical and social weakness. Then there was the nucleus of the group, Christopher Bennett. Chris didn't have the strongest personality, the most overbearing leadership skills, or the quiet wisdom that was found in Emmett. And yet, he was the adhesion that made all of the disparate personalities and life experiences mesh into a social order that would mark the rest of their lives. He got upset about the silliest things, least of which being the confusion about the true location of Little Africa. That soapbox was just one microcosm of a million causes that made Chris the most nervous and stressed-out 11-year-old boy in West Texas. He was often anxious about something, often fighting some battle over the most insignificant minutia, and often raising his voice to a shrill pitch that made Justin want to punch him. Everything and everybody seemed to matter to Chris, to the point that nobody even paid attention anymore. At least not consciously. None of the boys realized that they had gravitated to him, and in doing so had gravitated to each other over the course of about 2 years. North Street wasn't always home to Chris. He had lived in several nearby small towns, including Brady, Mason, and a short stint in Menard. Mac Bennett was his biological father, but Chris had only vague recollection of him. His stepfather was John Matson. John was a trucker who always seemed to come home angry and attempted to take the edge off with copious quantities of alcohol and cigarettes. This often gave way to horrendous fights between John and Chris's mother, Laura. The fights turned violent on more than one occasion, eventually costing John a few days of his freedom as he waited for Laura to bail him out of the Tom Green County Jail. He would later brag that he spent 3 nights in the same cell as Henry Lee Lucas, although that claim was never substantiated. Chris never saw John again after that short stint in jail. He left for his usual run to San Saba and never returned. Following John's abrupt departure, Laura and Chris moved into a house on North Street to live with her mother. Then she passed after a very short fight with a very aggressive cancer. He was 5 when his grandmother died. Laura and Chris had lived in that same white house with chipped red trim ever since. Chris started kindergarten at Austin Elementary the day after the funeral. Eventually, the memory of his grandmother faded until she was just a mental footnote. He hardly thought of her at all by the time he entered the first grade, having no appreciation of the impact that his late grandmother had on his life. He was too focused on insignificant details to think about her. Matters such as his left shoelace that had lost the tiny plastic aglet and was frayed could consume his full concentration. Therefore, details like the parting of Grandma were quickly pushed out of his consciousness until the issue perceived as most pressing was addressed, after which he would mentally move on without a concern for the loss. His grandmother was largely responsible for the ensuing years of semi-stability that Chris enjoyed while growing up in the house on North Street, but he was too distracted and inwardly focused to realize that until much later in life. Laura worked as the receptionist at All Smiles Dental and occasionally supplemented their income as a waitress at Fiddle Strings on Friday and Saturday evenings, leaving Chris home alone until she arrived in the very early morning. Fiddle Strings was a honky-tonk near the intersection of Knickerbocker and Loop 306. It was a side gig that suited her social desires more so than her financial needs. The extra money was great, but she was in it more for the relationships. She took care of Chris's basic needs, keeping him alive, but his emotional and spiritual needs were largely on himself to tend to. The months and years moved relentlessly forward as Chris looked more and more to the outside for friendship, security, and a sense of belonging. This was why the tribe of local boys that had organically formed around him was so important, although he didn't realize at the time that he could hardly have lived one day without them. Just knowing that the group existed was something that Chris could hold on to even when he was alone. One side effect of Chris constantly overthinking everything and everybody was that he had also developed empathy not often seen by others in his peer group. So it was Chris who looked back when he got to the halfway point of the North Side Hill. As had been the case so many times before, he saw Emmett several car lengths behind, giving it his all but quickly losing the battle against gravity. Trent ground past Chris and kept pressing on. Left crank, right crank, inhale, left crank, try unsuccessfully to sing. He went onwards and upwards, craning to catch up with Kyle and Justin. Chris hopped off of his bicycle that was already moving at a snail's pace and watched Emmett until he could go no further. Emmett also stopped riding, struggling instead to walk his bike up the hill and still getting winded by the hike and the weight of the bicycle. Eventually, he caught up to Chris, who was waiting patiently. He stopped and took a break, hardly able to answer the question, "You okay? Do you need your inhaler?" Emmett shook his head and said that he was okay, gasping for air and slowly returning to rhythmic respiration. Then the two of them walked their bikes up to the top of the small hill and took another break before climbing back on and continuing north. The rest of the group was nowhere in sight by then. Eventually, Chris and Emmett reached Junius Street, and then the North Concho River overpass after a short jog to the east past Jefferson. They went off-road just before arriving at the overpass and walked their bicycles down a trail that descended parallel to the street above. Soon they came to the topmost intersection of the steep concrete ramp where it met the underbelly of the overpass. From there, they awkwardly maneuvered underneath the bridge, wrestling with their bicycles until they made it across the dark, graffiti-covered concrete embankment, moving diagonally down until they encountered earth again. They connected up with a thin trail that led along a ridge, flanked on either side with mesquite trees and tall, chaotic bushes and weeds. The river, which was really more of a creek at this point, trickled about 15 feet below. The trail descended somewhat, leveled off, then climbed until they finally emerged to a clearing, largely devoid of trees or undergrowth. After another 20 feet, give or take, they came to the edge of a 40-plus-foot cliff comprised mostly of soft, black soil. This was a good vantage point where they could see the entirety of the enormous whole that constituted the fabled Little Africa.